Garrett Kaiser is a contributing editor at Harper's Magazine, a former Guggenheim Fellow. He has written for many leading publications, including the Los Angeles Times, the New Yorker, the New York Times, and the Washington Post. But long before he found success as a writer, he taught high school in rural Vermont for 16 years. In the fall of 2010, after a 14-year hiatus, he returned to teaching by accepting a one-year position at that very same high school. And in his new book, Getting Schooled, The Re-Education of an American Teacher, he gives us a month-by-month account of that year, discovering what had and had not changed while he was away. It's published by Metropolitan Books. I'm very pleased it has brought Garrett Kaiser back to our show. Welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
When did you first decide that you wanted to be a teacher?
Well, I showed leanings in that direction as early as second grade when a teacher of mine used to sometimes invite me to teach the class. The decision to become a teacher was a somewhat ambivalent decision in that I was interested in literature and interested in writing, and my parents felt wisely, I think, that I needed some way to earn my daily bread. And so the most logical choice to me and to them seemed to be that I trained to be a teacher.
Sure, you assumed that you would teach English, but
yes.
Did other subjects also interest you?
Certainly other subjects interested me along the way. I've sometimes wondered if I would have liked to teach history. Those first lessons I delivered in second grade were about rocks, minerals, planets, and dinosaurs. But I think
you were that kid. I remember.
I was that. Yeah. And I was.
Did you choose the school in Vermont because it was local, or was there another thing that appealed to you?
Well, I did my graduate work in Vermont, and then after graduate school, and my wife also did hers in Vermont. And
she's also in education.
She is. She's a speech-language pathologist, and so we just went looking for jobs.
Is this a big school?
The school where I taught is not a big school. It's a regional high school of about 400 students.
Do you remember your first day of teaching?
I don't remember my first day distinctly, but I certainly do remember my first year vividly.
Did you feel like you were in over your head?
Much of the time, yes.
But you wound up teaching for 16 years.
Yes.
Why did you finally quit?
Well, I was probably wondering when I was going to quit from the very beginning. It's interesting that the first year we were given the option to sign up for making a pension payment or not, and I signed up not to, thinking, you know, in another year I'm going to be out of here. I stayed on for a mix of reasons. One, I found satisfaction in the work. I needed the money. I finally left when I was able to obtain a book contract that seemed as though it would help me get launched, and there was a transitional step in that I asked for a year's unpaid leave to homeschool our daughter, and I helped her, and she helped me, as it were. She went back to public school, as had always been the plan, but her dad did not.
All of these things sound like they are temporary. Decisions. Now, why would you homeschool somebody when you are a public school teacher? Wouldn't all of the other teachers look askance at that? Wouldn't people in the community wonder what message you were sending out?
Well, it's interesting. One of the things I did before we all made, and when I say we all made, it was a whole family decision in which my daughter was also involved.
How old was she?
She was. She would have been... it was sixth grade when we did that. And so she would have been, I guess, around 12. And I went to her teacher and said, I'm thinking of doing this, the person who had her the previous year. And he said, if you can swing it, it might be a good idea. They had combined two classes, what had previously been two classes, into one large class of very needy students. And the needs were, by our lights anyway, not being met. But we always believed in public education, and as I say, the plan was always that my daughter would return. Your question, why would I do that when I was a teacher? goes right to the heart of the matter, because I began to feel, as I watched my daughter struggling over homework assignments, that here I was, you know, playing this heroic role of writing letters of recommendation to Ivy League schools for my kids, and my own kid was being shortchanged. It became intolerable to me.
You write that your daughter at a young age wished that she could split you into two people. Did you feel that your work conflicted with the time that you could spend with your daughter?
Oh, most definitely it did, and that was a factor as well. I spent a lot of time, you know, as many teachers do, on planning and correction, and my daughter often got the short end of the stick. Those homeschooling years, I also homeschooled her a year between eighth grade and high school, were two of the best years of my life.
Were you also trying to write at that time?
I didn't do too much writing at any time when I've been teaching. I've always kept a journal. I've always put words on paper. But I've always found it difficult to write anything of any substance and also teach. Teaching is just so demanding.
Is it ironic that your daughter went on to become a teacher? What does she teach?
She works assisting a speech-language pathologist. Her degree is in early childhood special ed. There is some irony in it, I suppose, although she, I think very much her role model was her mother, who works with that age group, and there was a certain logic in her following in her mom's footsteps.
So you got the book deal,
mm-hmm.
and then you found work as a freelance writer, but
That's
also
correct.
As an editor. Why would you return to teaching and at the same school? Another book deal?
No, I returned. No book in sight. In fact, I had a book deal, and the first thing I had to do after signing the contract to teach was to tell the editor that he either needed to up my advance by a lot of money or give me more time to write the book. He chose option B. No, my wife, through whom we had the health insurance, was needing to change jobs, was in transition. And I wanted her to have the freedom to do that, especially after all the years she'd supported my writing career. And so I looked all over for work. Interestingly, the only place I found it and the only place I was given an interview was at the high school that I left 14
not in,
years
not
before.
Not any college or university?
No,
or,
I tried creative writing departments. I tried private schools. I didn't try public schools because my license had expired, but no, I was not even invited to any interviews.
Well, in the intervening years, one of your former students had become the principal.
Yes.
What did you remember about him as a student? Was he principal material in your mind?
He was. He was president of his class, I think his freshman year and maybe other years. He was a tall, broad-shouldered farm boy with impeccable manners and a good work ethic. And if somebody told you he might be president someday, although he lacked the corruption necessary, perhaps you would have thought, yes, he might make it to that place.
Had you kept in touch with other former students?
Yes, I've kept in touch with a few of my former students over the years. Some of them now I would count among my dearest friends.
Did their career plans surprise you? Or the career paths? I think about my own career path, which has involved being wanting to be an artist and then working in advertising and then being in the record business and then writing, doing all sorts of other things before I ever wound up in this job. So it was almost impossible to predict where I would go. Did you find that was generally the rule?
I don't know if I found it was the rule, but I certainly found examples that would be like yours. One student, for instance, very good English student, one of the best I ever had, wrote his senior thesis on Milton's Paradise Lost and is now a cutting-edge web designer, and that is the work that he does.
Why did your wife want to leave her job at the public school where she was working?
She saw the program that she was in go from a very fine one to one that had some difficulties such that she was beginning to feel that she couldn't do her best, and the children weren't being served at the level she felt that they ought to be.
Was she in the same rural Vermont town?
She was in the same school district in which I taught, yes. In fact, we were a package deal when we were hired. I mainly got hired, to be honest, on her coattails. They needed speech pathologists. English teachers were a dime a dozen.
You stay there because she was there, but a lot of people, once they graduate, once they go to college, wind up moving on. Did most of your former students move on?
Some of them
did. If they didn't become principals of high school?
Some of them did move out of the area, but it's interesting the number who have come back or who remain in that area.
Your wife, one of the reasons that she had a problem, you write that the administration didn't really respect the preschool program. Is that a problem for teachers in general, that they think they're doing the kind of work they should be doing, and then they run into attitudes that surprise them?
I'm sure that it is. I mean, my experience is fairly localized and limited, but I'm sure that teachers find that, and I'm sure that teachers of early grades find that. Administrators, politicians play a great deal of lip service to the idea that nothing's more important than early childhood ed, and they're right in that. But when it comes to practice, their attitude tends to imply that anybody can do it because it's only sandbox anyway. I would put preschool teachers and their knowledge of childhood development, thinking skills, et cetera, on a par with the knowledge of any single group of teachers in the country.
My guest is Garrett Kaiser, who is the author most recently of Privacy, also The Unwanted Sound of Everything We Want. He is a contributing editor at Harper's Magazine, and he has written a new book called Getting Schooled, The Reeducation of an American Teacher. It's published by Metropolitan Books. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with Garrett Kaiser. He's written a book called Getting Schooled, The Reeducation of an American Teacher. It is published by Metropolitan Books. Here you go. You come back to this school after 14 years. Were the students this time around very different from the ones you'd taught earlier?
I wouldn't say very different. If anything, they seemed a little happier, maybe a little more courteous. The school was functioning at a good level, but there were some differences. I think the place of electronic devices in their life was certainly something that I hadn't experienced before. The economic problems have always been there because the Northeast Kingdom is a hard scrabble place. So that was a constant, even though we were dealing with the aftermath of the 2008 debacle.
So we're talking about a poor region.
Yes.
But those kids have technology as well. How has technology changed how teachers have to do their jobs these days?
Well, that's a complicated question, and it's changed it in a number of ways, I think, for the better and for the worse. I think on the positive side, one of the things technology has done is it's provided some assistance to students with various disabilities who in the past would have been sink or swim kid, and now certain things that were, you know, deal breakers almost in their progress have been ameliorated by those devices. I think that when the devices, one of the bad things about the devices is they are, of course, marketed and promoted within an economy that thrives on creating the fear that people will be left behind if they don't embrace certain things. So that I sometimes observe in education that the how something gets done, in other words, is it being done digitally or not digitally, begins to overwhelm the why, as if the how is the why. If it's done with this device, it is therefore a success.
If I had to do any research when I was a kid, I looked into the encyclopedia that my parents bought volume by volume from a supermarket. It's part of special deals. That was common at the time. It was rather inadequate. Today, of course, somebody could just Google up a subject and get a lot of different views on the same subject. I would think that that would enrich the lives of students today.
Well, it certainly does to a large extent. Kids who have access to the internet have access to a wealth of information that you and I didn't have in our growing up. However, the readiness of that information can be seductive in luring them away from other sources, in convincing them that what doesn't show up on their screens immediately isn't of any value, or there's no need to find it, and also that whatever shows up on their screens, because it's there on that wonderful screen, must be magic. I say in the book that educators can't speak three consecutive sentences without using the phrase critical thinking, but often show a want of critical thinking in the analysis of electronic devices and online research.
They've also led to more cheating, although we cheated I'm assuming that plagiarism is rampant, although there was plagiarism in the past as well. Is it easy to spot plagiarism?
I wouldn't say it's easy to spot. I think there are certain telltale signs for spotting it. I think in some ways plagiarism can be overcome by sound pedagogy. If you are working with a student on a paper and you're going through the steps and you're urging them to follow the steps and revise with the steps, there should be no surprises at the end. But if you're saying, here, do this, and I will take it 2 weeks from now, you may get something that was lifted from someplace else.
You mentioned that this is an area of rural poverty. We usually, when we think of poverty these days, we no longer think of Dorothea Lange photographs. We think of the inner cities of our major metropolises. Do you think that rural poverty is being ignored? In your case, you say that they were as affected by what happened in 2008 as people in the big cities were.
Well, I think rural areas in general are being ignored, and all poverty is being ignored. But certainly you put those things together and rural poverty, which, by the way, I think is important to say, includes people of different colors and castes, just the way urban poverty does.
Can students who live in poverty, who face family instability, still succeed in school? Isn't a bigger burden than it is for people who come out of stable, financially secure homes?
They can succeed in school, and in some cases they do succeed in school, but it is, of course, harder for them to do so. And once they do succeed, they have as one of their dubious rewards having contributed to the idea that their poverty didn't matter that much, because obviously here's a high test score from a kid who was part of the food insecure segment of a population. So therefore, everything's groovy.
Although you mentioned caste, there were rich kids in the school as well.
There were kids who had some money, yeah. Yeah, and whose parents
had some money. I suspect that they didn't integrate with the poorer kids.
Oh, no, they did. In a small school like that, they mixed. There simply weren't enough of anybody for, of any group, well, certainly of any rich group, for them to put themselves apart. And when we say rich, we're speaking relatively. In other words, a rich kid in my community is not a kid whose father works for Morgan Stanley. He's a father who maybe is the president of the local branch bank, which you could rob with a plastic fork and get away with all $10,000.
You have to give me the address.
Okay.
were you having to deal with the same issues that we're hearing a lot about, teachers who upset about teaching to the test? Was Common Core an issue while you were there?
Common Core was mentioned as on its way, and the first Common Core tests in Vermont, standardized tests, all given by computer, of course, will occur in the spring of 2015. We were dealing with the New England Common the New England assessments, the kneecap exams there. But certainly there were teachers grumbling about the idea of teaching to the test. We did do some things that were teaching to the test. But I have to say, to the school's credit, that the teachers and the leadership continually stressed to students that they were not proving their worth, that they should not feel pressure, that they should just do their best.
You seem to have adopted some unconventional teaching methods. You began your classes by playing music, and yes, not the music that the kids might have chosen, the music that you chose. And then you had your 10th grade students complete a research paper. Didn't some teachers discourage you from assigning a research paper?
No one discouraged me, but there were teachers who felt, or at least one teacher who felt, that students in 10th grade were too young to master that skill. It was a, you know, pedagogical difference between him and me.
Would you have done the same thing when you were teaching the school earlier?
I would have, except I didn't teach the 10th grade except for 1 year in my first stint, and that's traditionally at the school been a time to do the big research paper, but or to teach that skill, but I certainly had students doing research, yes.
And on some difficult subjects like female genital mutilation for 10th graders.
Yeah, yeah.
So these are 15-year-old kids?
Yeah, yeah. I had a kid say, I want to do a paper on people who disfigure themselves, and she was interested.
She was thinking of cutting.
Carving and things like that, and I made a judgment call based on what I saw of the kid and to say here was another topic in that area where we're not talking about individual pathology but about custom and culture and some controversy surrounding that.
And how did her paper come out?
It came out well.
Were you surprised by the results? Did most of the kids do a good job?
No. I was surprised by some of the results in a positive way, what was achieved, and there were other cases where I felt things should have been in place that ultimately were not in place.
Do you think that they're predictors of future success?
Just ask me again.
In other words, if a kid hands in a really good paper,
yes,
is that going to suggest that that kid is going to do better in the future than the kid who had handed in a really lousy paper?
I think it's probably more likely that the kid who handed in a good paper will be successful at other things. I would be the last person to say that the kid who handed in a poor paper or no paper is going to fail thereafter. I think prediction, when you're talking about how people will develop and grow and what they'll become, is best left to astrologers.
Now, we have no time left.
Okay.
But I have to ask you why you quit. Did you think that you might want to stay longer? Are you missing it at all?
I miss the kids. I miss things about the work. I don't miss the job, and I feel I'm doing the work that I'm best suited for.
And were you writing the book while you were teaching?
No. I was.
Did you take notes?
I took notes thinking. I've always taken notes in a journal through every intense experience in my life. Few of them have resulted in books, but this did.
So your medical insurance problem is resolved now?
My wife, yeah, I'm living off the wife's medical insurance again.
Garrett Kaiser, who's written for most of the major publications that we read, and has written a number of books. His latest is Getting Schooled, The Reeducation of an American Teacher. It's published by Metropolitan Books. Thank you so much for being on our show again.
Thanks. It's always a pleasure.